Westwood One presents Two Chairs and a Microphone.
Checking 1, 2.
Here's your host, Paul Mercurio.
Well, hello there, everybody. Thanks for checking out the podcast this week. Before I get to my guest, I want to thank everybody for tuning in the last couple of weeks. I've been getting a lot of listens on the podcast, especially the Bobcat Goldthwait interview, which was basically the audio from a TV show that I shot with him. A lot of great comments about that. And last week's podcast, Tom Bernard, great radio legend. People love how frank he is and open and honest. So thank you for checking those out. And if you haven't, check them out. And if you have, tell your friends. And we're building nice numbers with the podcast, but need to keep building and need you guys to support us. So please tell your friends about it. Send the links around. It's Audio Boom or iTunes. Real simple. And my guest this week is Colin Quinn, the great Colin Quinn, great comedian, good friend. Really cool conversation with him. It's funny, but we also get into how he writes so much and so well. We talk about ethnicity, we talk about race, we talk about his one-man shows. He's done a bunch of those, and he's always got another one in the works. Hope you enjoy it. It's a really cool conversation with him, and you can see me doing stand-up this week in New York City. I'm at the Comedy Cellar, Stand-Up New York, Gotham Comedy Club, Comic Strip. Go to their sites to see where I'm going to be and what time, or my website. And please, please leave some comments if you haven't done so on iTunes, and tell your friends too as well. We appreciate any nice words. Enjoy the podcast, people.
Now it's going. All right, hey everybody, welcome to the podcast. It's like my first time doing this. Very special guest, good friend, great comedian, tremendous writer, one-man show extraordinaire, Colin Quinn.
Thanks, Paul. You don't say it often except when Paul McCartney was on. Still the biggest moment. You realize you're the only one who got a Beatle on? What questions did you ask him? What was the best question that he answered?
The best question?
Yeah.
You're a Beatle. Why would you be fucking a chick with one leg?
No.
And then it was a... No.
Silence.
I said, I think the question, are you serious? Want a serious answer?
Yeah.
I said, as a comedian, a performer, we tend to lapse into, at times, wanting to give our fans what we think they want because they want it, right? You're huge. You're in your 20s. You have the world at your feet. Where did you guys get the balls to keep changing your sound radically and not worry about losing your fan base?
That was a bad question.
That was a great question.
Because the answer is John. Paul's like, I never thought of doing it. Well, John kept forcing me.
It's John. Yeah, the part where he's like, oh yeah, it was a democracy was a kind of a.
Did he say that?
Yeah. Part where he had to laugh, and then the other part was when I talked to him about Wings, and he went to Wings, and he goes, yeah, you know, I was in charge, but I was still collaborating with the other. Could you imagine like the bass player of Wings going, right. Hey, Paul, I don't think,
Yeah. Oh, it's hilarious.
It was great. He was super nice.
He's like a down-to-earth guy. For a guy that was a Beatle, he's like the most down-to-earth person I ever met.
He was really great, but I kind of got like flustered when I asked him to do it, right?
Of course.
I turned into the guy. You know, like that hot chick in high school you always wanted to ask out? You're like, you know what? She's going to say no. Let me get it out of my system. Instead, right. She says yes.
Right. Now what do you do?
I'm
right.
Like, and he goes to me, how would we do it? And I'm like, now we're at the in New York at the Colbert Studio. I go, and I literally like stammer. Like, I go, I'll come to London. And he's like, well, we're in New York. Why would you come to London? And then he goes, is it easy to do? And I actually said to Paul McCartney, yeah, it's really easy. I know you're super busy. I don't want to be a bother. Look, you could do it on your phone naked from your toilet. I'm like, what the fuck am I doing? And then we exchanged phone numbers. It was crazy.
Yeah, I remember. I heard the message.
It was crazy.
I love the message. Hello, Paul. It's Paul.
It's great. Let's talk about you.
All right.
So it's going to be 10 minutes just to read your fucking credits.
Don't read all these boring credits.
Listen, you've done everything. Your one-man shows are amazing. You have a book out, the coloring book. Comedian Styles, Race Relations in America, The New York Story, which is happening now,
which
amazing run. I'm hearing great things about it. I'm coming. I swear to God.
We're getting extended through the fall.
Oh, really? Yeah, I wouldn't have done that if I were them, but good for you.
Why it's sold out?
That's
sold out every night.
I know. Everything I've read about it is fantastic. Is it coming off better than you had anticipated? Because there's got to be, even though you've done a lot of this.
I always anticipated to come off this well.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Because you're inherently a negative, suicidal person.
Yeah, I am, but I feel like that's more been the result of feedback than me personally. Like, I always think, I'm an optimistic person when I start anything. I think this is going to be great. Yeah. This is great. I mean, we have to be, in a way,
yeah.
To even start to, Look, every night you go on stand-up stage, you're not thinking I'm going to bomb. You're thinking I'm probably going to kill.
Yeah.
And then we bomb sometimes, but so this show, I was like, no, this show's going to be great. But it was one of those last-minute thrown-together things. This show is different from the others, and then I was like, part of me is like, you know what, don't bother to do this right now. What are you doing? It's just, you know, it's a New York thing. It's about a time that's passed.
Was it as a result of the coloring book? Just for people who don't know, I mean...
Yeah, the coloring book...
You had The Irish Wake, My Two Cents, which is about the economy. Long story short, Unconstitutional, which Jerry Seinfeld directed and is directing this. Now The New York Story.
Right.
And all of them have been financial critical hits. Why was this as a result? The book, and you focus on the book and then thought, oh, well, maybe this is a natural sort of result of the book?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was, actually. It was a result. It was because I wrote the book, and as you know, for stand-up comics, writing a book, even if the whole world read it, which they didn't, but even if they had, it's not satisfying compared to what you want, which is to say it out loud in front of people and then make them laugh and applaud at you.
Yeah.
Like, that's... You get spoiled. Like,
and you're always working in really interesting topics and subject matter. Was the stand-up the impetus for the book, or was the book the start, and then you started to spin the stand-up?
Yes. The book, I had to do the book because I had a stupid book deal. So then when I was doing the book, I was like, this sucks, man.
Did I see you? I read somewhere in reading up on this, like, you said this is my first and last book.
Yes. Yes. Unless this book became this thing where it sold like a billion copies and then they offered me big money, I'll never do a book again.
You're so prolific. Even for you, you're so prolific as a writer.
I'm prolific, but I like to get feedback. We're spoiled. We're stand-ups.
That's a good point.
I don't like just sitting there in a quiet room and then one editor goes, hey, that was a really clever chapter. It's like, oh, no.
All right, listen, we're at the Cherry Lane Theater.
Yes.
You're in the middle of your run.
We're on the stage itself.
A very close friend of both of ours. A man named Lewis Black, I was with him last night at a Daily Show function, has a message for you that I'm going to play on my phone. You ready?
Okay.
And I think our listeners...
This should be inspiration.
Colin, I don't know how you feel when you look up and see my poster there, but realize I got there 15 years ago, and it really didn't help. I hope it does you, really. It took forever after I worked there. So I hope it comes around. I hope it comes to you.
That's his love message.
Yes. Well, Lewis, his poster is up here.
He is, yeah. That was his first thing. So now,
but they still love him here.
Oh, you're like the Mr. One-Man Show in the city. So here's from the book. Let's talk about the book for a minute and everything that comes out of the book. I got this thing. Okay, you said... Thank God for immigrants. They're the only ones who have any personality left. They'll allow themselves emotions, judgments, all those qualities that we are evolving past. I don't know what they're saying, but I can tell they're speaking honestly.
Right.
And that, along with the core idea of that we're not really talking about race. We're in neutral, and we have it since the 60s, right? Seems to be the impetus for the book and the one-man show.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of the one-man show in the book, yeah. Well, it's just become like, I don't blame people for not talking about race, by the way.
Mm.
Because if you talk about race, if you gave your honest opinion, unless it fit into the parameters of what's considered acceptable,
right,
you'll be fired.
Right.
So I can't really say, oh, we don't talk about race because we're...
No, you're right. Here's the issue.
I
literally was standing there, especially like the Daily Show audience, very PC. And
right.
I'll go, and someone looks dark, whatever. I'll go, you're Puerto Rican. They'll go, I'm like, what? I can't, are you Asian? And they go, and I'm like, well, can I can't even... No pun intended, call a spade a spade.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, you can't. And the other issue for me, which I'm talking about in my act, is I don't know where European immigrants stop being minorities in this country such that it's okay to make jokes about them. Like,
right,
I'm Italian, you're Irish.
Right.
My grandfathers came here in the early 1900s. They were the minorities. They did all the shit jobs nobody wanted to do. But now you could do, like, you know, Italians are in the mob and the Irish are drunk and happy.
Sure.
Babies. What was this about, you getting frustrated on stage in stand-up and you needed a place to say this?
Not frustrated. It's been like this since the beginning. I mean, it's been like this since the late 80s, early 90s.
Well, don't you think Carlin and Pryor and Lenny Bruce were able to sort of touch on these issues in a way that...
No, I don't think they touched on them. Think about it. Well, how did they touch on them? That was a different time. The way they touched on them at that time may have been edgy. But it wasn't really edgy what they were saying racially. They were edgy in other ways.
So what is edgy for you in the context of a race conversation that you would like to be able to say?
I would like it to be really open. I wouldn't even... honestly, I wouldn't even say anything out of context right now. Everything I say is in my work because, you know, if you even, everything's a convert, everything's in racial terms is just little chopped off things. So it's like, you know, people are don't want to go, nobody wants to be the viral example.
Well, you talk about that, you know, it was the right that was always like this.
It was the right for many years.
Suppressing the comedy.
For 180 years in this country, whatever it was, since the beginning of the country, it was the right.
Right.
All the censorship, all that came from the right.
Right.
Until probably the 70s and 80s. And then suddenly it became the left. And now it's almost all from the left.
Right. You know?
And it's not to say if the right had power, they would do it too. I'm not saying they would,
but
they don't have that kind of media.
But it's not just political; it's cultural.
That's what I'm saying. Right. I mean, if the right had cultural power.
I mean, Jerry Seinfeld's directing this and came out with that. What I didn't think was very controversial, but it was
me neither.
Was like, oh, you can't go work in a college because they're so PC, which is true.
I know, but everybody acts like it's a controversial statement, right?
And that was that. This is before my time, but the places to work. The counterculture places to work were the college.
Yes, that's
in the 60s,
exactly
the
right.
70s. That's where the place where you could go, Kent State and whatever.
Right.
So how did this flip and why did this flip? And why are we so, because I'm struggling with this too, because I like to talk about some of these themes too.
Of course. We like to talk, the whole point of being in the community, you want to talk about what you want to talk about.
Whatever it
is. Exactly.
I say my favorite basketball player growing up was Larry Bird.
Sure.
In part because he was great, but also because he was white.
Yeah.
And then they go, and I'm like, I relate to the white player, like the black player relates. And then I
And exactly. And you, whether they agree or disagree, they should be happy you're being honest.
Right.
Saying, oh, my favorite player was so-and-so.
Right.
Dennis Johnson, who was black, but he had freckles and red hair. he was like, I used to make a joke that he was like he was a Boston black guy. Red hair and freckles.
You had to be. It was actually makeup.
Yeah,
when I took it
off. And, when did it happen? Who the hell knows? I mean, why did it happen? If I knew that, I'd be a rich man. But I'm just saying, whatever it is, people somehow have decided like that these things are okay, you know, in the media.
But you talk about, see, you can't back down though. You can't, you and I and the rest of us have to be willing to sort of, you just talked about it goes out, it goes viral. So you have to be careful what you say.
You have to make sure that whatever you say is exactly what you want to say. It's not that you can't say what you want to say. You have to make sure that what you say is articulated exactly the
way. So are you more circumspect now than you used to be in the past because of the over-the-top PC culture that we're in?
No. I mean, probably.
I don't think you are. I mean,
probably less, but I'm very, I try very hard to be very clear about what I'm saying.
Otherwise, you'd get misconstrued.
Well, this is where deliberately misconstrued, you know.
You talk about the social media, right? And, and you use this term digital hysteria,
right?
Which I think is a perfect way to put it. Now, we're also both culpable because we're both on Twitter as comics trying to get people to come see
our shit. Of course, we're trying to create digital hysteria.
Right? So what I'm trying to figure out here is the control is with the average person now, and it's never been more so the case.
Right.
And so is that a good thing or is that a bad thing?
Because it's good and bad.
Because it's...
It's good, and bad. Everything's good and bad. Everything's contradictory. That's the other thing people seem to have lost in society. Everything's a contradiction. You know what I mean? Like, things are good. Things can be good and bad at the same time. People can be saying one thing and acting another way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
People... So it's... Yeah, it's good and bad.
But with that... But so How do you undo that? How do we unravel the snake of PC and... people being circumspect or feeling sort of inhibited in terms of what they want to say.
You can't. All you can do is your own thing.
What are you trying to do with this book and with this one-man show?
I'm just trying to say what I want to say. You know, I don't care. I mean, I don't feel like I can change the world. I'm just saying what I feel like saying and trying to make it so that it's funny. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, ultimately, as a comedian, here's what I believe. I believe that, yes, I want to say my point of view. I think I have something important. Blah, 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 all that. But if I'm not getting laughs, I'm not a comedian.
That's
how I feel.
Yeah, but I got to tell you, and people should know this, you're the purest artist as a comic that I know.
Thanks.
Because that means, it's a nice way of saying he bombs a lot. No. No. I will go down to the cellar and watch you because, and you don't ever really lose the audience, but you'll go there. But like, you're a purist in that sense, but still entertaining. And
And it's courageous, you know? And so I do think that you kind of have to, I mean, look, it's easy to get real broad and get a shit ton of laughs.
Of course,
and start making really bad movies and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
We all know people who have done that.
Sure.
And, you know, how do you ever feel like, let me just give them what they want, you know, let me just whatever, you know, like, because sometimes you're going down roads with an audience and you can feel like the audience has got to kind of come along.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't be good at that. I mean, I wouldn't know how to do it.
Yeah.
Honestly, I wouldn't know, because you know how comedy is. Comedy has to be what I want, what I think is funny.
Right.
When you go on stage, you're not writing what the audience thinks is funny because you don't know, and I don't know.
But the social media thing has changed that, right? So, like, you start doing stuff, people don't like it, or people start, everybody's got a fucking opinion.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And then you get, not you, and you and the third
right,
person one, gets influenced
right.
by that, right?
Right.
Like, everybody's got a fucking opinion.
I know.
Like,
and social media does affect a lot of TV
and
shows.
And the internet, right?
Yeah.
You know, my mother's got an opinion about movies. She's 88. That's
right.
She knows what she's talking
right,
about.
Right, right, right.
So where did this turn for you? Because you still do stand-up, but
yeah.
you have been so prolific in the one-man shows. Were you feeling like, and you've done the road like all of us, which
right.
is different than being in New York or LA, for good or for bad.
Sure.
And they both have their pluses and their minuses. Did you feel like in the clubs that you were just getting handcuffed in terms of what the audiences were willing to go along with, and you wanted a better pulpit for yourself?
Yes, but not because of political correctness. Because of, because theater can be politically correct too. It was because of,
subject matter?
The drinking, and they just only like dick jokes after the late show.
Right.
You go up there, you try to be a comedian, you could be saying the funniest stuff.
Oh, no.
If there's not a dick joke near the end of it, the crowd's like, okay, that was okay.
Oh, you do the third show at the Cellar. You have to do a different set than you're going to do in the first
That's
show.
Right. And
it's like, you have to muscle it.
You have to muscle it. And sometimes, muscling it does create a muscle, but it can also create a hardened, you know,
yeah.
a muscle-bound comic
yeah.
where you don't even feel like, wait a minute, can I talk about this for a minute?
Yeah.
You just feel like, you get that, you know, you see comedians that are just like, okay, I got to get there now. And it can be a little anti-creative too. It's the greatest, look, we're lucky because we're not indulgent because of those crowds. We learned you better get to your point and you better get to your joke.
Right.
We don't want to fucking watch you ramble. So we're not going to be these indulgent, preachy, whatever.
Right.
We don't get away with anything.
Right.
But there's also the other side. You become protective.
Right.
And suddenly you're like, I'll be creative for 10 seconds and make sure they get the laugh.
Yeah.
And the laugh comes, like
oh,
you said,
yeah.
we'll get the laugh in areas that are not necessarily creative or
no,
intelligent.
No, exactly. I call it running for cover. Like you go to that thing, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know,
I used to call it lion taming too. Because you're out there like,
yeah.
But I mean, yeah, either way, running for cover, lion taming, these are the things that help the muscle build, but it also
you have to
you
be disciplined. Like all of us, were you starting out with sort of just the broad, easy stuff and then eventually kind of became more of a social conscious comic that sort of made more commentary?
I mean, I used to talk ethnic stuff in those days because I grew up in Brooklyn, so
yeah.
I was always doing ethnic stuff. And,
yeah.
you know, it's funny because Chris was there tonight, Rock,
yeah.
and we were talking about the early days.
Hack.
And we, yeah, and we were talking about the early days
yeah.
of stand-up and
yeah.
all the, you know, all the, what people were doing.
Yeah.
And we was always right, and we always, but in those days, a lot more people were doing, like, regular stuff. And, like, we used to both have, I remember both of us had routines on the death penalty, but they were, like, pro-death penalty. And both of us had routines on prison and just all these routines about stuff that, so it's like, I feel like all comics, with very few exceptions, all comics try to talk about issues that matter to them.
Hmm.
But like you said,
it takes a while to get
there. When it becomes a war, then you can't, you have to run for cover.
Right.
You know, you can't explore. But I feel like I was always talking about certain things, but in those days it was a different climate in the country.
Right.
So you could really talk about stuff and people were a lot less like touchy. It started in the 90s.
Was there a moment where you think, oh, I got a handle on this? Because ultimately, a great artist gets, and you've done that, you've got your sort of point of view and your Colin brand,
right?
Do you remember sort of when you started to go, fuck it, I need to go to another level with this in terms of challenging myself, challenging the audience, really making this an art form and not just a guy telling jokes? Maybe you were like that from day one. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I remember seeing Eric Bogosian.
Yeah.
And Whoopi Goldberg's one person shows. Yeah. And I was like, wow, yeah. I love that. That looks fun.
Yeah.
And it was stand up, but it was also something else.
Yeah, yours inspired me that way. Seriously.
Oh, nice. Yeah, nice.
Yeah. And
nice.
Louis Black's too. Yeah.
It's great. It's great.
Yeah, because it's a platform. I want to talk about Park Slope where you grew up and I want to talk about where I grew up, and I have a question for you. And this is in the context of how you feel about race and everything. And you say, today it may look like a Swiss village, but Park Slope, Brooklyn in the 1970s was maybe the most mixed integrated, they called it a neighborhood in the history of the world. Park Slope 70s was magical in a weird way. And then you talk about you had Puerto Ricans, Italians, Jews, all blacks, all living on the same block.
Right.
Now, I grew up in an Italian neighborhood in Rhode Island in Providence, and there was the Italians lived in the Italian section, and then like a mile or two away, the blacks lived in South Providence.
Right.
The Jews were rich, and they lived on the east side. The Irish were cops, and they lived in another section.
Right.
You brought blacks into my neighborhood, and there were fights.
Oh, sure.
I was brought up racist. Yeah, I was brought up to be racist.
Yeah.
My uncle thought that they were all on welfare, and they should be put on a super tanker and nuked. He would say that to me when I was 11.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? So my question is, are you romanticizing Park Slope, or was it really as good as you remember it to be?
No,
because I can't imagine.
No, it wasn't like everyone got along. There was fights all the time.
So then, why do you wish that it were like?
Because
that?
It was still, it was mixed. It was like we had Italian neighborhoods and black neighborhoods where exactly what you're talking about existed.
Right.
But that wasn't Park Slope.
Right.
That was Bensonhurst. It was all Italian. You never saw a black guy there unless he was running for the L train. And when you went into Bed-Stuy and Brownsville in those days, you better be, you know, you better be in a cop car. You know what I mean?
Right.
There was no way you went in there. You know what I mean? And so, I mean, I'm not romanticizing Brooklyn. I'm saying, but Park Slope, because everyone lived next to each other, there was always a few people in each group that'd be like, all right, let him go. You know what I mean? Like, so there was people that, like my friend, let's say I had black friends. So even though their brothers might be gang members or whatever, you know, that would hate white people, when you're in their house, your friends with their brother, they're not going to do nothing. They're not going to do anything.
Yeah, you say in your book that you had, your kitchen would have, you know, black kid, Jewish kid, Puerto Rican kid.
So everybody had there was a lot more overlap.
That's and that makes you more tolerant, right?
It makes you more tolerant, the overlap, and it makes you more, yeah. Although the sad part is, as people got older, a lot of people did drift away from each other. But there was still that memory.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of kids have that. Maybe you had that in school.
Yeah.
Where you're like, yeah, we used to be cool, and now look at us. We're so far.
Yeah.
And it's kind of sad, but it's the way it is.
Yeah, and it's like, but it's all learned. You know, my Uncle Johnny was a dentist, and a black guy came into his office. He would not wait on the guy. He had a toothache.
Wow.
So he pretended to be a janitor, my uncle, with a mop, and went out. And when the guy asked if the janitor, he said, no, the guy's gone.
Oh, and so sad.
And I see this at 12.
Yeah.
And I don't know how I'm not a racist.
And do you say, and do you think your uncle was racist, or do you think he just felt peer pressure from the neighborhood? Like, you fixed a black guy's teeth, you know what I mean?
No, I think he was.
He just literally didn't want to touch a black guy's mouth.
I think he really felt like black people, which was odd because he was brilliant.
Right.
He was literally calculated to be a genius, okay?
Yeah.
But he had this thing of like, all the blacks are on welfare, all the blacks are, you know, blah, 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 blah. They're bad for society. They just have kids out of wedlock and they don't give a shit, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the Italians, the neighborhood now is just completely mixed.
Right.
It's like, but this is a time when I would run around in the middle of the summer at 10 o'clock at night, and Bobby Falvel's mother would yell at me like she reminded me. Like, everybody watched out for everybody.
Right.
But it was very Italian-centric in my neighborhood.
Sure.
And there was some overlap.
And like I said, there was Bensonhurst like that, Bath Beach was like that, the Middle Village, Queen. I mean, there's a lot of Italian neighborhoods.
Right.
And everybody knew, you go in an Italian neighborhood, you better be, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But like I said, Park Slope had a big overlap. But even then, there was still things would happen, especially as people got older.
Right.
People started to separate a little bit,
right.
You know? But, you know, there was still that natural thing of growing up together. But there was something, there's definitely something there. And I feel like a lot of people that went to mixed schools, like they knew there was those moments where you're like, yeah, we almost got along there. And then whatever happens, and it doesn't work.
Yeah.
So it's not like I think there was a solution there. I'm just saying there was something there that was a little better.
Yeah, no, I can see what you're saying. I mean, I want to, you know, you talked about sort of also like there are certain things we do want, like we're not having a real conversation about race in this country, you say.
Right.
Explain why you feel that way. I don't disagree with you, but
Well, what we said, like we said before, Only a fool would have a real conversation about race. You want to lose your job, then have a real conversation.
Right.
Because you can only speak in the most high-minded kind of platitudes and say, you know, racism in these generalities, right. And so it's never going to get real unless you can. I know. You have to leave. We have to pay. Unless you speak, if you really decided to say, guess what? You're going to hear but from other sides of the issue. You're going to hear people from every angle
right.
of this racial conversation.
Right, right.
Instead of just like, racism is bad, there's the bad guys, and here's the good guys. Guess what? That's not the way the world
See,
is.
But why can we have those conversations about other controversial issues like rape and gay marriage?
We can't.
Religion. Well, I mean, there.
Well, rape, I don't know if there's two sides to it. But.
I mean, no, no, but the conversation about, you know.
Gay marriage.
I think you make the point that, you know, a lot of female comedians do rape jokes
than guys.
And yet it's like, right, okay, but. So it seems like race seems to be a certain animal in and of itself.
Yes,
that
it is.
Almost like it's like the third rail.
That's
of societal
right.
issues, whereas
I agree.
Gay marriage and other, you know, religion.
We can at least play with them a little. Not as much anymore, by
and
the way. But
why?
I mean,
why?
Because I mean, you know, there's other
going
things.
Going back to slavery
look,
in this country, maybe.
Yes, Caitlyn Jenner is off limits.
Right.
So, like, I made a lot of jokes about Bruce Jenner.
Right.
You can't make jokes about Caitlyn.
Yeah, but here's Chris Rock, who's been working on this bit, and I don't know if it's okay. I'm saying it. He brilliant take. He goes, I get Caitlyn Jenner. But is it okay for me to think it's a little weird for 2 minutes and
yeah.
not be an asshole?
Audie Lang said the same thing.
And that's exactly right.
Audie Lang said, I need a minute with this.
That's exactly right. And that's the beauty of
but
stand-up.
But that's the beauty of stand-up. But even that, it's like, okay, that's as wild as you can get.
But
you're right.
But
the
here's
race
the problem.
Is the third rail.
We live in a world where nobody wants to have any rules anymore. Rachel Dolezal is a perfect example, right?
She
pretends to be black. She gets a job at the NAACP. And when she's challenged on it, she goes, well, if I feel that way, I am. It's like, no.
Yeah.
It's fine if you feel that way. But then when you start to use that conceit to deceive people
sure.
to get jobs that you wouldn't ordinarily get, then you cross a line. And I feel like we're living in a society now where people just want to go, hey, it's so PC now. There are no rules about anything.
Sure.
Like, you want to go steal a car? It's like, well, I thought it was my car. I should be able to keep it.
Right. But you, like you said, the real thing, the real third rail is race.
Right.
All the other stuff we can talk about a little bit.
Right. All right, we got to wrap up, but I imagine one last thing. You talked about in the context of working on SNL, like, you maybe I don't want to say appreciate, but don't realize the thing, how good it is that you have when you have it.
Oh, big time with SNL.
Yeah, is that because of just the nature of being comics and always looking on to the next thing? And what is it that you look back now on and thought, wow, that was really amazing? You talk about it being a democracy in a weird way, that
yes.
if the joke flew, it flew, and if it didn't, it didn't.
Just the fact that you were in this room full of 80 people and you were able to live and die, just like stand-up comics. Stand-up comics.
Explain that, pitching your stuff to the
pitching
people.
Pitching your reading sketches in a room full of 100 people,
writers,
80 people.
Yeah.
And if people want to laugh, they're going to laugh. And if people don't want to laugh, they're not going to laugh. It's the democracy of what we do.
You you say life is like delayed reaction, is what you said, and it's really interesting.
Oh, it's so sad, yeah.
It's like, but you do it. You're the best for doing this, man.
Thanks, Paul.
Love you. Congratulations.
Love you, brother.
All right, brother. All right, that was Colin Quinn. So funny, so quick. Just love the guy, and he's the nicest human being on the face of the planet. He didn't shave for the interview. I was a little insulted, but that's a whole other story. Check me out this week in New York City at the Comic Strip, Comedy Cellar, Stand Up New York, Gotham Comedy Club. And please tell friends about the podcast, send the links around, and please leave a comment or tell some friends to leave comments on iTunes. Thanks again for checking it out. Appreciate all your support. We're building some nice numbers. Please, please, please spread the word, and we will see you next week.
A Westwood One podcast production.